looking back at the Founding Fathers, their influences, and philosophies. For the past 4 years, journalist Thomas Ricks has been teaching at Bowdoin, living in an historic Maine house, and working on a big project, a book examining how and why the Founding Fathers thought the way they did, but from a different perspective. Instead of focusing primarily on Enlightenment thinking, Ricks looked at how George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison were influenced by Greek and Roman leaders and thinkers. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The book, First Principles, has received rave reviews and a lot of attention, in part because understanding the Founding Fathers gives us important perspective to the challenges currently facing our nation. What is the United States of America? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. In his previous books, journalist and author Tom Ricks tackled topics ranging from American generals to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to Churchill and Orwell. In his new book, he looks at how America's founding fathers were influenced by the works of the Greeks and Romans. The book's title is First Principles. Tom Ricks, thank you for joining us and welcome back to Maine Calling.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
We invite your questions and comments. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Tom Ricks, just learned that your book is number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. Congratulations on your success. And does, in your view, do you think this speaks to a hunger for what Americans are looking for today as we live through this turbulent times?
I think it does. I was really surprised that it made the bestseller list. I thought, you know, this was pretty obscure stuff, Greek and Roman influence on the revolutionary generation in America. But I think people right now are saying, wait a second, how is this country supposed to work? Why does it seem like it's so chaotic? What is, you know, does it, what should I care if the president doesn't turn over power gracefully? Isn't that in the Constitution? And so these are kind of fundamental questions. And there are actually answers out there that are in this book.
So interesting. I enjoyed it a great deal, and it taught me so much. And one of the themes that is throughout the book that I think is so interesting is the Founding Fathers' conception of the idea of virtue. And virtue is a word that was used, thrown around very, maybe not thrown around, but used copiously in the writings that you source. What was the conception of virtue for the Founding Fathers? Why was it so important? How is it different than the idea we have of virtue today?
This is actually one thing that really intrigued me as a writer going into this book, is just because a word appears and we think we understand what it means, it doesn't mean that they meant the same thing by it. And virtue is a great example because it was so important to them. But it had nothing to do with the way people use the word nowadays. I mean, when they talk about virtue as a kind of euphemism for female chastity, a woman of easy virtue, that's not at all what they meant. What they meant was public-mindedness, putting the common good above your own interest. And they thought this was essential for anybody who was going to participate in public life. And they used it, as you say, copiously. There's this wonderful database called Founders Online. Government can do good things. This was done by the National Archives and the University of Virginia. They've taken every word that the revolutionary generation wrote in speeches, letters, diaries, pamphlets, notes to themselves, and they put it online and it's searchable. So I can tell you that these people, the people who signed this country, used the word virtue much more, I think twice as much, as they used either freedom or liberty.
And by virtue, when you say they meant doing things in the common good, you see this used in all sorts of ways in terms of Washington, for example, at Valley Forge, saying it is only virtue that is keeping this army together at this point.
Yeah, the sort of the willingness to not just be about your own self, your own interest, what's good for you, in thinking that somehow you have to think about the general welfare, which, by the way, is a phrase that appears twice in the U.S. Constitution. The general welfare. We don't talk about that enough, I think. By general welfare, they meant, you know, the common good, things like having a clean environment, having good roads, having public safety, or something particularly pertinent this year, having good public health practices.
We're talking about how the Founding Fathers, you're looking into how the Founding Fathers are influenced by Greeks and Romans. Today, one may take a Roman history or Greek history class in high school or college, but their entire education is based on the lessons learned from these, even at that time, ancient civilizations.
Well, the problem was, here they are trying to design a new country that's not based on monarchy. And there aren't a whole lot of examples out there in history that they can look to. And so they look to a few Greek city-states, and they look especially to the Roman Republic. And for them, the Roman Republic was the central narrative in world history. And the events of the Roman Republic, especially its decline and fall, to them have the urgency of front-page news. How do these people run their government, and what made it collapse? And especially James Madison is asking himself, okay, how can we be a republic that doesn't suffer their fate? How can we design a republic that will last a long time?
And the question doesn't really have an answer. Different people have philosophies about why republics fail. One thing I'm curious about is this whole worry that they had that a city-state, a nation that's too large could not be a republic. I'm looking at a quote you have from John Adams, which I think is really interesting on a couple levels. Liberty, which has never been enjoyed in its full perfection by more than 10 or 12 millions of men at any time, since the creation will reign in America over hundreds and thousands of millions at a time. In a couple ways, that's interesting because Adams is pointing out that republics don't seem to last if they're for a lot of people. But he's also projecting that the United States is going to become a huge country. It's just fascinating.
I have a lot of problems with John Adams. He's querulous. He's vain. He was a lousy president. He thought that any newspaper editor who criticized him was a traitor and should be thrown in jail, and he threw a bunch of them in jail. Nonetheless, John Adams was a brilliant, honest man, and in many ways a visionary. He was the first of these first four presidents to get the ball of revolution rolling, and he did look in very long terms, over hundreds of years. But I think the person who came up with the answer about large republics is James Madison. And Madison's great insight, that he borrows some from Montesquieu and some from some Scottish philosophers, is divide power, spread it around. So in the Constitution, they spread power between the states and the federal government. In the federal government, between three branches, the executive, the judicial, and the legislative. And in the legislative branch, they divide it between two houses, the House and the Senate. And so power is dispersed so much that nobody can really be in control. The only way you're going to make progress, the only way you're going to get anything done, is if you're willing to cut deals, find compromises, and form alliances.
And let's talk.
I think Madison would say these days, "Hey, gridlock. That's not a bug. That's a feature. If things stop, that's because power is dispersed so much that people aren't cutting deals the way they need to."
Let's talk some more about Madison. Learned so much about Madison from your book, Tom. I knew that James Madison was the father of the Constitution, but the amount of research and thought he put into this project of coming up with a new U.S. Constitution, I did not know about. Tell us, what did Madison do to prepare?
I love little Jimmy Madison, as they used to.
And you say little for a reason.
Oh, yeah, he was about 5 foot, 5 foot one, maybe 110, 115 pounds. He was sickly, had some form of epilepsy, did not have a good speaking voice, and was not a very social guy. Yet, he achieved this enormous feat. I would basically summarize it as, if George Washington gave us the country by winning the Revolution, Madison is the second most important founder, because then he's the central figure in designing the country and kind of you know, building this country. So if it's a house, Washington won the land, but Madison was the architect. So Madison, during the time of the Articles of Confederation, the 1780s, says this country ain't working. This is not the way to have a country. We got to do something. And he sits down and he reads hundreds of books of ancient Greek and Roman history, really studying it rigorously as a political scientist. How do these ancient systems work? And how can I avoid some of the problems that philosophers have seen, that you couldn't have a big republic or that they won't last a long time? And then he starts beating the drum for a constitutional convention. Then he goes to the constitutional convention. He's the first man to arrive in Philadelphia for it. And he gives one of the most important speeches, laying out a lot of thoughts. And actually, some of the things we have in our government today that aren't working are because of some of his thoughts then, but a lot that did work. And then he leads the campaign to ratify the Constitution. And for his final act, he, with Thomas Jefferson in the 1790s, kind of begins inventing the American political system. You know, people like John Adams and George Washington thought you couldn't have factionalism. Factionalism would rip apart a country, that you didn't want to have partisanship or political parties. And Madison says, time out, fellas. The only way it works is if you have checks and balances, so you can balance competing interests. And we're going to have political parties and have other political parties, and they will fight it out and win and run the country that way.
Mm. One of the little details I like is that when Madison's doing research, he writes Thomas Jefferson in France, and he says, can you send me some books that I can't get here? And what does Jefferson do?
Well, he sent him trunk loads of books. I mean, literally, cargo loads of books.
Like 500 books, right?
Yeah. And Madison reads them all. He shows up at the convention basically having done a PhD dissertation on how to design a republic. The difference is he then has to persuade everybody to go along with some of these ideas. But it works. And the amazing thing is, 250-odd years later, here we are. Now, I think they would criticize us. They would say, guys, we designed this thing to be changed. That's why they call them amendments. To amend something is to make it better. And America has really stopped amending the Constitution over the last 100 years. I think they would say, you need to make some changes.
We're speaking with Tom Ricks, author of First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. Let's talk about some of the Romans that were part of everyday parlance back then. The founders knew these names and talked about these people as though they walked among us. Catiline, Caesar, and Cato. I think most Americans have heard of Caesar, but tell us about who Catiline was and why that name was so important to the founding fathers.
Catiline was a conspirator who wanted to overthrow Rome and take it over. And to the people in the 18th century, this is the worst possible thing you could be, someone who wants to overthrow the republic for his own narrowed, you know, personal gain. And so that was the worst thing you could call somebody in the 18th century, a Catiline. By the way, Aaron Burr got called a Catiline a lot. People did not trust him, even though he was elected vice president. Cato was a fascinating figure. He's the guy George Washington really tries to emulate. Cato is a Roman politician noted for his characteristics. He's frugal, he's prudent, he's wise, he's reserved. And rather than surrender to Julius Caesar when Julius Caesar is taking over the Republic and becoming a monarch, Cato commits suicide. There's a famous play in the 18th century, George Washington's favorite play, called Cato. And there are a couple of lines in it. At one point, someone says, I regret I only have one life to give to Rome. Another character says, give me liberty or give me death. These were lines that people remembered and used in their own speeches. And so George Washington, who has a volcanic temper as a young man, learning to contain it, learning to control himself, really models himself on Cato. John Adams, by contrast, models himself on Cicero, Roman politician, also an opponent of Julius Caesar, trying to preserve the Republic. And John Adams, to his great credit, goes from being a school teacher in a Massachusetts backwater with no money to becoming really the Cicero of America, a great orator and very persuasive in leading the country into revolution. As I said, though, I have some problems with him later on as president. He is not this cute teddy bear of a guy that Paul Giamatti played in the HBO miniseries. He's not this lovable character who comes out in David McCullough's biography. He's a cranky guy who's very vain and really bitter about being a one-term president. He's thrown out of office in the election in 1796, very bitter about having to turn over power to the opposition. But to his credit, he does turn over power to Thomas Jefferson, and I wish the current occupant of the White House would take note of that. The first one-term president, though I'm upset about it, did yield up power to Thomas Jefferson.
After the break, I want to talk about how the concepts of virtue and classicism evolved as America became a young nation. But before that, I want to talk to you about the role of religion. We've talked about virtue. We've talked about the Greeks and Romans. What about Christianity? How much did you find in terms of what the founders were thinking about in terms of Christian thought?
Not much. There's very little God in the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. There's a couple of kind of references to a supreme being, but it's not even a specifically a Christian God. The Revolutionary Era is one of the least religious phases in American history. In fact, the number of ministers per capita, I think, triples in the 50 years after the Revolution. But there's not a whole lot. There's a little bit of Calvinism that comes in through the Scottish Presbyterians, but they are really holding religion at arm's length, and they're much more focused on Roman and Greek history and models. That changes, though, when sort of you get this populist surge in America under Thomas Jefferson, and the people really take this notion that they are sovereign, that we the people, as the Constitution says, we the people own this country. And in the early 19th century, that really starts changing, and you see religious influence really grow in America.
So interesting. We're speaking with Thomas Ricks, his new book, First Principles. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or email us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Freeport Wild Bird Supply, a place for bird enthusiasts for nature gifts, feeding supplies, and more. Curbside pickup and ordering at freeportwildbirdsupply.com.
The 2020 holiday office party is going to look very different this year, with big in-person events a no-go and most people working remotely.
Normally, the Christmas party is a victory lap for the company. Well, if we put everybody on Zoom, it's just another meeting.
I'm Elsa Chang. How some companies are jazzing up their Zoom holiday parties this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And All Things Considered is later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Join us for this season's final edition of Maine Public's Tiny Screen online concert series coming up tomorrow at noon. Featured will be versatile violinist Callie Sugatsky, live from the State Theater in Portland. Our Tiny Screen concerts are available online through Zoom and archived for later viewing at mainepublic.org. For more details and to sign up for this Thursday's concert, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we're speaking with Tom Ricks about his new book and New York Times bestseller, First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. Share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Tom Ricks, as I alluded to before the break, even though the founding fathers, when they were crafting the Articles of Confederation, when they were discussing amongst themselves all sorts of ideas for their new nation, talked about virtue a lot. But a few years later, as we're moving into the Constitutional Convention, as we're moving into the election of our first, second, and third presidents, the word virtue doesn't seem to be front and center anymore. What happens?
I think what happened is the people took the Constitution seriously. And the revolutionary generation were these people who had been educated in college, William and Mary, Harvard, Yale, Princeton. They were really elites. But the people say, hey, we're the people, we're running the country. They start running with that ball, and they don't care a lot about ancient Greek and Latin heroes. First of all, they have their own heroes, people like Washington. And second, they're dealing with the problems of this new country, how it's going to unfold. They're basically saying, we're going to run the country the way we like. And one thing they don't have much time for is classicism. So it disappears pretty quickly.
What do you think the Founding Fathers would have made of America today? And I mean that on a couple levels. What would they have made of the size of the country, the population of the country, the diversity of the country?
I think the first thing they would be say is, wow, this thing worked. The machine we designed worked. You know, and they kind of made this stuff up, you know, sitting around on a hot summer in Philadelphia. How many people should be in the presidency, they discussed one day. Should it be one, two, or three people? And they said, you know, having three people didn't work for the Romans. Let's make it one. At one point, they were having an argument about who should impeach the president. Should it be the Supreme Court or the Congress? And there's this long argument about should the big states have an equal number of senators as the small states? And ultimately, they decide, yeah, big states and small states all will have two senators because that's the way one of the ancient Greek confederations did it. So I think they'd be pleased to see, first of all, the sustainability of this machine, that the machine, the Constitution, is resilient. Even with a president like Donald Trump, who didn't seem to understand a lot of the Constitution, who was surprised to find that the Congress and the Supreme Court acted like they're equal powers to him. Even with him, the Constitution seems to have worked. So I think they'd be pleased by that. The second thing I think is they would be stunned by what a mess they made with slavery. They wrote slavery into the Constitution, the fundamental law of the land. They lit the fuse for a civil war. Now, it's easy to second guess them now. They did this because they thought it was the only way to hold all the states together. In fact, South Carolina and Georgia said at the Constitutional Convention, if you people talk about freeing the slaves, we're leaving. And that means that those two states would be outside the new country, and that means that foreign powers, France, Germany, France, England, and Spain, could come in and get involved. So I think they'd feel sorry that they messed that up that badly. I think the third thing that would really surprise them is how we have let money dominate American politics, that we've made the dollar more important than the vote. I think they would say this is explicitly not what we had planned, not what we thought we should have or you should have. And I think they would charge us with being in danger of losing our democracy and becoming more of an oligarchy, that is, a government run for and by the rich.
We'll go to Gordon calling from Brunswick. Hi, Gordon. Go ahead.
Hi, Tom. Gordon Adams. I had a question for you about slavery. You just touched on it, and I was wondering to what extent the founders that you're writing about reached back into ancient history with respect to thinking about slavery, which of course existed in ancient Greece and to some extent in ancient Rome as well. Was there any philosophical connection they made, or was this just simply a political compromise, like you said?
Good question, Gordon in Brunswick. They relied a lot on the fact that the ancient world had slavery. And that Aristotle at one point seems to approve of slavery. He talked about better people should be in charge of worse people. What the founders did not look at was the fact that ancient slavery was not race-based. It was not a matter of your ethnicity or your skin color. Anybody could be a slave. It was seen as a result of misfortune. You've been captured and you became a slave. And also that ancient slavery generally was not as harsh as American chattel slavery. There are a couple of exceptions, like Sparta, but generally, ancient slaves had some rights. They could petition the emperor if they felt they were abused. And if they were freed, and a lot of them were freed during the course of their lifetimes, their offspring could hold public office. Compare that to America, where there have been slaves here for hundreds of years, but it's only in the last 60, 70 years that black people have begun to hold a lot of public office in this country. In my lifetime, finally, the offspring, the descendants of slaves are holding office. But that's taken a long time in American history.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon, thank you so much for calling with your question. From email here, please have your guests discuss the role of Native Americans in our founders' considerations. I believe it was significant.
I think this is the same guy who's harassing me on Twitter. I think we just have a difference of opinion. In 4 years of research, I didn't see a lot of influence of Native Americans on the system of governance discussed at the colonial, at the Constitutional Convention or in the Declaration of Independence.
I'm going to go here to an email from Constantino. America learned plenty from the Roman Empire. Imperialism, colonialism, attempted genocide of the native people, and enslavement.
I entirely agree. This is not something that the founding generation focused on. They really thought that the Roman Republic was the apex of civilization. In their defense, they were not so much focused on the Roman Empire as they were the earlier period, the Republic. They explicitly did not want to have a Julius Caesar running this country. Julius Caesar to them was a great villain, an evil figure. And one reason that Americans came to think that George Washington was such a great man was that he was not a Julius Caesar. He did not use his position as general to seize power at the end of the Revolution. Instead, he followed the example of another legendary Roman, Cincinnatus, a general who, at the end of a war, said, "I'm done," and he went back to his farm. And that's what Washington did, not once, but twice. He gives up power as a general at the end of the Revolution and goes back to his farm. And then, after being president for two terms, he says, "I'm going to step down now and give up power." And it's a striking moment in American history. At the inauguration of John Adams, John Adams is now president, but he turns to Washington and says, "Well, you should leave the room first." And he bows to Washington. Washington bows to him and says, "You're the president. You leave first."
Frank on Facebook says, "Just finished Rick's book and enjoyed it. Question, which Roman or Greek writer that he studied has the most to say to our country today?"
Which Roman or Greek? It's nobody. Nobody has asked me that. I feel like I'm playing Stump the Chump.
Intentional, I'm sure.
Probably Polybius, because he studies the rise of Rome. And he's trying to figure out what makes Rome powerful, what works here. And it was the same question that a lot of the founders were asking. Personally, though, I'd say my favorite of all the stuff I read is Aristotle's Politics. Not because it was centrally important to them, but because it's the first thing I read as I began this book. I started rereading it the day after Donald Trump was elected. And one thing that really struck me in it was he says that oligarchy, ruled by the rich, is the least stable form of government. And it illuminated Donald Trump for me.
Speaking of that, I'm wondering if the founders anticipated someone like Donald Trump.
Absolutely. A couple of things. At one point, Thomas Jefferson says, sometimes bad men will get into office, and they're looking at the Constitution as a way of limiting those effects. So remember, one reason that Madison disperses power so greatly is to limit the effects of one person, one bad person. Madison also says at one point, if men were angels, we wouldn't need a government. And so they're consciously designing something to balance people who sometimes will be petty, will be vicious, will be jealous of other people. This is a system that Madison would say, yeah, we designed it not just for good people, but for bad people too.
We'll go to get Larry calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I'm wondering about your statement about they would be surprised that money is more important than people. Clearly, Mitch McConnell wants the rich to rule America. It's clearly going to come before the Supreme Court at some point. What sections of the Federalist Papers and what portion of the Constitution to which are which, you know, are you referring to that, you know, obviously a lawyer wants to point that out to the Supreme Court?
I would begin with the general welfare phrases that occur twice in the Constitution. The Supreme Court especially, but I think Americans too much, have made the market the judge of everything. Even, you know, selling off parts of the environment to corporations that are willing to pay fines for air pollution. More emphasis on the common good, which is a fundamental concept in the Constitution. And I think they also would simply say that money is oligarchical. And so Supreme Court's decisions are not always right. I mean, the Supreme Court has made some howlingly bad decisions, like the Dred Scott decision in the 19th century and then near the end of the 19th century, declaring that separate but equal was just fine. And I think Citizens United, that allowing money to run rampant in politics is another mistake. The way I would address it is not by asking the Supreme Court to change it. I would like to see a constitutional amendment that said, you know what? Corporations are not really people, especially for the purposes of politics. There's nothing in the Constitution that says corporations have an equal voice in politics. That's something that the Supreme Court made up, and we need a constitutional amendment to change that. But remember, they designed it to be amended. There are a lot of changes we could make. I think the Supreme Court should have terms of 14 to 18 years. I think we should question whether it's really correct to have California with like 30 million people have two senators and have Wyoming with 500,000 people have two senators. Is that fair? Is that what the founders intended?
Larry, thanks for your question. An email here from Mark. I haven't read Tom's book, but I have a classical and cultural history and philosophy background and taught similar subjects for 3 decades. I'd like to have Tom address the influence of Newton and Kant and Enlightenment rationalism on the founding fathers. I'd also like to have him address more the concept of deism.
Sure. The Enlightenment is huge for the founders. But remember, the Enlightenment is built on classical history. Kant says the Enlightenment is about a new way of thinking. And indeed it is. It's about reason. It's about seeing politics is something that people can be reasonable about and have debates, and facts can be introduced and decisions made on the basis of those facts. Montesquieu, probably the most important political thinker of the Enlightenment, French philosopher, essentially invents the modern liberal state, a state based on tolerance, on division of power, on a balancing of liberty and justice. These are all things that the founders subscribed to. But remember, Montesquieu himself, this key Enlightenment thinker, hugely influential on especially the Scottish Enlightenment, which in turn is very influential in America. Montesquieu's writings are very much about Rome. He wrote an entire book about the decline of the Roman Republic, and then his masterpiece, The Spirit of Laws, about, I'd say, one-third of it, is about Roman history and his analysis of how a state is run and what its flaws are.
We'll go to Jamie calling from Portland. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Yes, I was curious what your thought is of people putting 21st and 20th century virtues on to 18th century individuals. I know people look back and they judge through the lens of today. Their actions in the past, and there's a lot of life experience between now and 300 years ago. So just curious about that.
I would say we shouldn't judge them by the standards of today. We should judge them by the facts. And so, for example, my opinion of Jefferson went down a lot as I researched this book. And it wasn't simply because he was a slaveholder. It was because of all the founders, I would say there was the greatest discrepancy between his words and his actions. He talks a good game about slavery and about how bad it is, especially when he's living in Paris. But he never really does anything about it. And when he's back home in Virginia, he doesn't really talk as good a game either. So he spends his life dreaming about liberty while living off the sweat of captives, people he considers his property. I think the single most shocking line to me that Jefferson ever wrote was when he comments that he grows enough food on his farm to feed all the animals, including the Negroes.
Jamie, thank you for your call. We are going to take another quick break. We're speaking with author Tom Ricks. His new book, First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling. With help from Bristol Seafood's Fairtrade North Atlantic Wild Scallops, harvested from the Gulf of Maine and found in the freezer at your local Hannaford.
I'm Curtis Chadbourne on the membership team at Maine Public. And on this day in Maine's history in 1997, Holmes Point in East Machias is added to the United States National Register of Historic Places. The eastern part of Maine is known to have historically significant examples of prehistoric and historic rock art, particularly the shores and islands of Machias Bay. The Holmes Point location is noted for its archaeological significance as a prehistoric Native American occupation site and for its high number of petroglyphs. Other notable rock art sites in the area include Birch Point, Hog Island, and Grand Lake Stream. Happy birthday, Maine!
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher, Maine Masons, and listeners like you.
I'm Robin Young. In his groundbreaking book, A Country of Cities, architect and city planner Vishan Chakrabarty said the way to fight global warming was to have everyone move into sustainable cities, make our carbon footprint smaller. But people are moving out of cities because of the pandemic. Does he still feel the same way? That's next time, Here and Now.
And Here and Now is today at noon here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Tom Ricks joins us. He's worked for The Washington Post and The Wall Street Journal, and his new book is called First Principles. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. So many interesting things in your book, Tom, but one of the things I want to touch on really briefly is the influence of Scots, the Scottish, especially Scottish educators, on our founding fathers. I didn't know about the broad influence there.
It's one of the things I think we weren't taught well in high school, and I don't know why. I think John Locke, the English philosopher, his influence has been overstated, and the influence of the Scots has been understated. The Scottish Enlightenment is fascinating. It's enormously important. Basically, they invent a whole bunch of new fields, demography, sociology, geology. But even more importantly, they invent the Industrial Revolution with a steam engine. And they start sending all these smart, young, poor Scots over to America to be tutors. They've been educated cheaply at universities in Edinburgh and Glasgow. They come to America, and they teach the Enlightenment to people like James Madison and Thomas Jefferson.
An email here from David. I just finished Hamilton, and I'm looking forward to reading First Principles. What are Tom's thoughts about Alexander Hamilton?
Alexander Hamilton. First of all, a brilliant writer. His words just leap off the page. Second of all, crazy. this guy, he is manipulative. He's conspiring. He is really arrogant in his handling of George Washington. He tries to manipulate the army to pressure Congress to raise money. And is quite a tragic figure by, you know, he does so much to help this country, to get the Constitution ratified. He effectively acts as prime minister under George Washington. Yet, by 1800, he tells a friend of his, there is no place in this country for me.
An email here from Wayne. How did they view the role of the press in our democracy? What might they think of the performance of the press today?
You know, when people talk about the social media upsetting and being so disruptive these days, I say, guys, just look at the history of the 1790s. In the 1790s, political newspapers begin emerging in America. You had newspapers before, but they were really just the shipping news. You didn't have newspapers that were for political parties and all about politics. And those start emerging under George Washington's presidency, and they become very loud under John Adams' presidency. And this is a problem because John Adams thinks that criticizing the president is illegal, and he starts throwing newspaper editors in jail. And basically everybody, the major newspapers opposing him, is either in jail or being threatened with being jailed. So it's part of the development of the American system, the sort of stuff outside the Constitution, what we call norms, not laws. Political parties begin developing with Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in the 1790s, inventing an opposition party. And while I've been critical of John Adams, I got to say, one-term president, angry about it, thrown out by the people, yet he turned over power to the opposition. There's a saying that the true test of a democracy is not whether you can elect a president, it's whether you can elect somebody from the opposition and have people in power give up power gracefully to him. It's an issue that we're actually kind of looking at right now. We have this norm that the president turns over power gracefully and helps his successor come into office. And you have a president for the first time in a long, long time refusing to believe the results of the election.
One of the things, the reflections I had upon reading your book, Tom, is that it seems as though today we think of the rapid pace of our world, and we think of how quickly everything is changing as though this is unprecedented. But you make a point that things changed very, very quickly in our young republic, in our young nation, not only politically with the advent of political parties and, like you said, the emergence of a partisan press, but also with the Industrial Revolution. I love the anecdote about, and I don't want to give it away, I want you to tell the story, about one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence.
He was actually the last, I think the last living signer of the Declaration, became the person who gave a speech at the beginning of the building of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, the B&O, one of the great early railroads of America. So he kind of spans from the Enlightenment into the Industrial Revolution. That said, I think we simply don't understand our history well enough. I think the 19th century had much more change than we're experiencing now. I mean, people talk about the internet and digitalization. In the 19th century, the railroad meant that for the first time, goods and people could move faster than a horse across land and could move 24 hours a day. And the second thing that happens is the telegraph starts moving information across nations and then across continents. The internet is nothing but a very fast and colorful telegraph. And the third thing is, with the Industrial Revolution, entirely changes the labor structure. People move off the farms and move into cities and factories. So these great and vast wrenching changes are occurring, I think much bigger than anything we're experiencing now.
We'll go to William calling from Bingham. Hi, William. Go ahead.
Hey. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering, in the beginning of the Republic, the only people who could participate, could vote, were landowners. And those landowners were maybe, 10-15% of the population. Women couldn't vote. Unpropertied men, white men, couldn't vote. So I always wondered how actually democratic was our beginning.
Sure. And William, I need to tell you that your question is, many people have the same question, pointing out that the founding fathers were pretty privileged. Tom?
Absolutely. I think in their defense, I would say it was not what we would consider democracy today, but it was a whole lot more democratic than anything the world had seen until then. They began this system They expected the system to change. They expected it to be amended. And I think most of them, not all of them, would greet the expansion of the franchise to women, to blacks, as good things that make the country broader and more stable as a democracy. But I think, as I said earlier, I think they also would look at us and say, who are you calling elites? You people have turned over your democracy to rich people. I'm not a big fan of Bernie Sanders, but I think one thing he's right is when he says that these days Congress doesn't regulate Wall Street, Wall Street regulates Congress. So the founders would turn around and say to us, you are in danger of losing the democracy that we started. You're becoming an oligarchy. What are you going to do about it?
Mm. And related to that, Tom, something I learned from your book is that there was some thought that the early capital would be Philadelphia or New York, but Thomas Jefferson didn't want to have any of that.
It actually was. It was, yeah, first in New York, and then it was in Philadelphia. And Jefferson hated the notion that it would be among the what he called the stock jobbers and the speculators. And he conspires with Madison to move it south. There's also some thinking that they were also more comfortable having the national capital be surrounded by slave areas rather than in the free areas of New York and Philadelphia.
We'll go to Michael calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm interested in the judicial philosophy of originalism and what you think about it. To me, it seems like one could come to any preconceived conclusion and call that originalism.
I'm wary of originalism, but I think we can have originalism of the left as well as the right. Originalism is usually associated with a conservative approach to the Constitution. Yet I say, what about general welfare? It's in there twice. Let's talk about general welfare. Why have we made the market more important than the general welfare phrase? If the people are sovereign, then the government should be run for the people, not for rich people. So I think there are different ways of approaching this. Also, we should be very wary of originalism simply because their worlds were different. One thing that really came home to me in the course of my research is that when we look at the ancient world, what we think of as the ancient world is not what they thought of as the ancient world. They hardly read the Greek dramatists, Aeschylus and so on, that we think of as being so important. They thought the most important ancient dramatist was Terence, who was a comic Roman playwright that nobody reads today, and I can tell you is unreadable, at least to me. So they had a very different. They thought Sparta was a better place than Athens. Samuel Adams, the revolutionary, not far south of Portsmouth, Samuel Adams said he hoped that Boston would become the Sparta of the New World. They thought Sparta was great. They didn't like Athens so much. Athens, what they saw as kind of flighty, anarchic, and probably too democratic.
Michael, thanks for your question. Another question from Lucy. I feel as though we should talk about the principles they adopted that maybe don't work today. What would Tom say are the things that the founding fathers learned from the ancient Romans and Greeks that could and should be abandoned now?
First of all, slavery. They really blew it, partly because they didn't understand that there was a big difference between the ancient world slavery and the race-based chattel slavery the United States had. Second, they made assumptions about states that we know not to be true now. For them, the biggest difference between states was Virginia had 12 times the population of Delaware. Now we have states that are 50 times the size of other states in population. But they would come back at us and say, well, amend the Constitution then. We designed it to be amended. One thing we could think about is should big states have three senators, the middle third, two senators, and the smallest third, one senator. Of course, that would not only change voting in the Senate and shift it more democratically toward where the population is, it also would change the way presidential elections work. But I think we should probably have a constitutional convention to talk about all these things.
An email here from Robert. The land-grant mission of our universities refers to, quote, not excluding classical studies. Should we revisit the role of classical studies in education?
You know, it's out there. I just don't think that people find it relevant, and people make their own choices. I think we could benefit from reading more of ancient philosophy, ancient history, but that's my opinion, and I wouldn't force it on people.
Mm. You end the book, Tom Ricks, and we just have a couple minutes here, with an epilogue, what we can do. And I'm just going to look at number one right now. Don't panic. Tell us about the conclusions you've come to.
Don't panic, I think, speaks to the resiliency of the Constitution. It was designed to expect there to be huge differences in American society and to be moments of crisis and bad people being in power. What's number two? I can respond to each of them with examples if you like.
Okay, go ahead. Number two is curtail campaign finance. We've already talked about that.
Yep.
Refocus on the public good.
Yes, the public good, general welfare, things like roads, transportation infrastructure, education, the environment. These are all the common good. The only way to really deal with them is with the government acting. So I don't think Ronald Reagan is right when he says government is the problem, not the solution. In some areas, government is the solution. One thing that really comes home this year, public health. There's no way that 50 governors can coordinate a response to a virus. It had to come from Washington, and it didn't.
Respect our core institutions and push them.
Yeah. The founders expected the most vibrant, energetic part of the federal government to be Congress. So while we need to ask Congress to step up and do its job, to not be so sleepy and not so deferential to the executive, to act like an equal branch of government with the executive branch.
All right. In just a few seconds left, I'm going to jump forward to number 10. I'm sure our guest, Kenneth C. Davis, would agree with this as well. Know your history.
Absolutely. And I appreciate your having me on. I think it's just a lot of fun to discuss all this.
Well, thank you so much, Thomas Ricks, for joining us. Thomas Ricks, Tom Ricks, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who lives in Maine. His new book is First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. Today's sound engineer was Lucy Suchek. Visit mainecalling.org for more information about all of our programs and to sign up for our podcast. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.